Welcome, friends and fiends. This is your host, film critic and comedian Nate Wyckoff, and I'm here to tell you about an exciting giveaway that Warner Brothers Discovery and Colton Classic Films LLC has put together to build your 4K Ultra HD film collection on digital. We are giving away four codes which contain digital 4K Ultra HD versions of Rebel Without a Cause, Maltese Falcon, and Cool Hand Luke. These are films that you absolutely must know as a film buff. You can get this code by being one of the lucky four people we pull from our newsletter list. So go to ColtonClassicFilms.com/newsletter and give us your email and your name, and we'll sign you up for the newsletter and we will enter you in the competition. That's all you got to do. So please go ahead and do that. The contest ends on April 30th and we will send out the winning codes on May 1st. Thank you so much for being a listener. And here's your episode of Colton Classic Films Podcast.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to Colton Classic Podcast. This podcast is important to me, but what's more important are the rights, privileges, and freedom from violence of everyone in this country and in this world. And that means supporting Black Lives Matter. If you'd like to make a donation, please go ahead and visit ColtonClassicPodcast.com, where we have a list of places you can donate and help out. And please stay safe.
Welcome to Colton Classic.
Welcome to another episode of Colton Classic. I am your host, as always, Nate Wyckoff, comedian and writer for Horror News Network. With me today, we have Tad Mastriani. Hey, Tad.
Howdy.
We have Jeff Tucker.
Hey, what's up? My head is normal.
We have an awesome lineup for you today of Aliens Walk Among Us theme. First up, we have 1993's Coneheads, and then to follow that, we have the lesser-known 1992's Bad Channels. So, I think a lot of us have heard of Coneheads before, even if you haven't seen it or if you're too young to have ever seen the individual shorts. Of course, it's a film that is based off the characters created in a Saturday Night Live skit, Dan Aykroyd and Jane Curtin, as an alien couple who have giant cone-shaped heads. And I love this movie. I know that there are differing opinions, but I also think this is probably the best Saturday Night Live film, next to maybe Blues Brothers, something along those lines. But again, the competition's not necessarily that stiff on that front.
I was going to say, is that much of an accolade?
Just as a summary of the film. So Beldar is played by Dan Aykroyd, the father of the family, and he and his wife, played by Jane Curtin, and her name is Primat. They crash land on Earth. They're supposed to take it over, but instead they crash land and they end up having to assimilate because their colleagues won't come and get them for a long time. And they end up having a child who is, of course, alien but raised on Earth. I think that pretty much... So here's the thing. Here's what I love about this movie right off the bat. I love the fact that this movie uses something so ridiculous as big cone-headed aliens to talk about social inequality and racism and illegal aliens. It's shocking how this movie from 30 years ago is talking about something that is still so, in fact, even more so on all of our radars. I don't know if anybody else was struck by that.
I think that for me that was the key kind of element I brought away from this. And I think that there's like a lot of these types of like films and movies where you watch them and you're like, oh wow, that's they must have had a time machine to know what was going on today. But the reality is probably somebody's gonna find an old recording of Coneheads 500 years from now, and there'll still be borders and people will still be pissed off at the people on the other side of the border for some reason. And and they'll still be issues with people crossing said border. So, I think the items brought up in this film will never die. And
unfortunately,
it will always be like that thing where somebody pulls this up and they're like, wow, they're talking... Man, a politician was just talking about putting fucking, things on people's necks to shock them if they cross the border, you know?
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Yes, I think you're probably right on that front. And as some background, just to, because we can't get away from 2 to 3 degrees of separation in any film we do here on Cult and Classic, because everything in Hollywood and in the film circles at large are connected. Steve Barron directed this film, who directed the 1990 Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, which is possibly my favorite film. And we referenced last week, our last episode, when we talked about Ernie Reyes Jr. So I guess the other thing that struck me in this film is how when Dan Aykroyd and Jane Curtin's characters are trying to assimilate in to, you know, US society, their helpers are inherently not white. First, his Beldar's employer is played by Sinbad, who runs like a appliance repair shop, and then he becomes a taxi driver and is helped by yet another non-white character. And I think it's never, of course, specifically, and that was, I think, Shishir Kurup who played the cabbie boss. It's never extremely obvious, but like in spoken language, but it's one of those cases where reality sort of falls into a really ridiculous comedy, right? Because, I mean, we're talking about people that are starting from zero with no social security number, and they end up being helped out and joining, you know, minority cultures. And everyone sort of, it's a sweet scenario. Everyone kind of is helping them, you know? And right now I found that really uplifting and really a nice change that I haven't experienced positivity for a while, you know?
I get you. Yeah. There definitely was like you know, that welcoming community for, you know, the previous generation of immigrants that, you know, I'm sure is probably, pretty real to some people, you know, in their experience. You know, then it also had the other side where, you know, they were just arbitrarily, you know, despised by a group of people. I think the interesting thing in this case is, you know, like a lot of times the fear comes from the idea that people are going to come across the border and, you know, destroy our society or destroy our way of life or whatever, right? They literally, the Coneheads, literally, that was they were here to come and, you know, take over the planet. So that was, the fears were real in this case.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah. So I like the kind of the double irony of that, right?
That is hilarious. Yes, that's true. And of course, in just like so many things, it's ends up being that they fall in love with our imperfect setup. And of course, later in the film, we get to see their imperfect planet setup. But just kind of to illustrate this idea of, you know, people helping them out in the minority situation and sort of characters who are from immigrants or immigrants themselves sort of summarizing the culture that Beldar is stepping into. Let's just listen to this bit with Dan Aykroyd and Sinbad as they're driving in a car.
Beldar, if you're gonna live and have kids, you're gonna have to get yourself together. Buy yourself a car, maybe get a hat for that head, and you got to do something about those teeth.
Teeth.
Beldar, you know what the key to success in this country is?
I do not.
Well, I'm gonna tell you. Look good, be your own boss, never get chained to a desk. When it comes to business, take cash only.
Look good, be your own boss, no desk, cash only.
You got it. Get more of that gum, man.
Of course.
On second thought, I better not chew and drive. I might hit something.
And what you hear there at the end of that clip is some physical comedy by Dan Aykroyd, because the gum he's chewing is, of course, a bright red condom. And it's that's brought back up later. It's not the first time. It's probably been made a joke, and it's not the last time, but it is still funny to me. And here's one of the things that I think makes the film successful. And we'll get to Tad. I know you actually don't like this film, so we'll talk to you about this. But Dan Aykroyd and Jane Curtin commit 120% to these characters. There is no satire in their characters. There is no, like, really, they play it 100% as if they are these robotic speaking, very odd characters, very intense faces. And in the beginning, before they acclimate, you know, before Sinbad gets into his device, they walk directly up and are like a centimeter from people's faces when they're talking. And the teeth that he mentioned, they have sharp, multiple rows of teeth. And there's this great, I mean, one thing that anyone who hasn't seen this film will be shocked by is the amount of comedy legendary in this film. I mean, it's not just the fact that it's an SNL film. It's that there are true legends of comedy every second in this movie. Like when he goes, Beldar goes to get his teeth capped. It's John Lovitz is the dentist. And that's one of my favorite scenes because there's this awesome practical special effect, which there's a lot of great special effects in this film, which I think people forget. I know I certainly kind of forgot about it after years of not having seen it, where Beldar is like open wide and his mouth opens all the way down like into his shoulders, and it's just this gaping maw with multiple teeth. And I love that John Lovett as the dentist, he is this, he's got this surprised look, but he's not shocked, and he's just like, well, all right, let's do this, you know,
get to work.
And that's a great moment. But Tad, I know that you said you saw this as a kid, and now you saw it now, and you still, your opinion hasn't changed much.
Not really. I mean, as an adult, I grew up not really liking SNL in the first place. So basically, watching an SNL film reminds me of how much I really didn't care for the skits. I didn't really care. I didn't really care for most of the cast, even though some of these people, in their own works, are hilarious. This is one of those movies where it feels like everyone is just a token to me. This may be an unpopular opinion, but they rotate through so many people, and it feels like John Lovitz was one of the only ones that actually got some decent screen time. I was like, oh, that's right. I remember Adam Sandler's a guy. Mm-hmm. David Spade acting like this spineless little twerp that he usually plays in every goddamn movie he's ever in. And then, oh shit, it's Chris Farley acting like he's a teenager. The thing about that is that even though it's so ridiculous, that actually worked well. It's like Chris Farley can pull off acting like he, like you can just suspend your disbelief for like a little bit that he looks like and acts like a 16-year-old boy, even though the man was what, in his late 20s, early 30s, around that time, I believe.
I believe so.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But
yeah.
I mean, Chris Farley was kind of like immature. Like that was, I think that's why he paired so well with David Spade in kind of their, like, David
Tommy
Spade
Boy, was almost like Black Sheep,
you know, 90-year-old man. And then, you know, Chris Farley is like perpetually 12. And they kind of play off each other in that sense, like really well.
And I do agree with you to a certain extent that, I mean, a lot of these appearances are token appearances, but I think that there's a little bit more credit to be given for certain roles. Like a John Lovitz has a bit, very small, but he has his moment. David Spade, I think David Spade did really well, but yes, he plays this is his signature role. But I mean, just the fact that he schmoozes up every single time to whoever is the highest priority in the room. It works well. And he doesn't break character either. And you have, I actually really enjoyed, you have Michael Richards, Kramer from Seinfeld, of course, who left comedy after having a racist blow up on stage, unfortunately. He plays a motel clerk in the beginning, and he plays it very straight, but he does a good job, you know, I think. He's like, can you sign the registration form for them to get a room? And he just takes a look, and it's just tons of, like, perfectly symmetrical symbols covering the entire document. He's like, that's fine.
This'll work.
Yeah, this will work. Right. Exactly. And anyone, cause we haven't seen Michael Richards for a long time. If anyone is interested in seeing it, I suggest they check out, his episode of, Seinfeld's series, Comedians, in Cars, getting coffee. Yep. And that, because he's in that, and it's a very interesting take. He said in response to, why don't you try to give it a try? You know, people love a comeback story. And he said, no, I did something unforgivable. And this is what happens when you do that. And that should be what happens when you do that. As opposed to someone like Louis C.K., who physically, you know, essentially sexually assaults a ton of women. And then is like, I'm so sorry, I did this. And then a month later, here's my new special, stop being so sensitive. I kind of respect that at this point when our people who do terrible things sort of own it. But, you know, back to the film, it's not just, you know, these people who have these parts that I think are kind of meaningful, like Michael Richards and John Lovett. You also have people who don't necessarily have those big roles. Like Adam Sandler, he has a scene. It's not necessarily a comedic scene. He plays like kind of a gangstery character who's giving Beldar his fake passport and social security and all that jazz. You have Eddie Griffin. You have Sinbad does have a larger part. But then you have Drew Carey. This is his first film debut, and he's just a taxi passenger at one point. Like, really, there isn't a reason to have them in there except as sort of a token. Look, I get it. I don't know if you caught Parker Posey is also in this very briefly. I believe she's one of the daughter Connie's friends.
I was wondering. I was trying to look. I saw the credits. I'm like, oh fuck, Parker Posey was here. Which one was she?
Ellen DeGeneres. I think this might actually be her film debut. She's in she's barely even on screen. You hear her voice more than you see her as a swim coach in one scene. So it's like, I mean, really every single little role is filled with somebody from comedy. And I do think that is fascinating, especially for those of us who haven't seen some of these people in a while. Dan Aykroyd has a lot of family members here in this film. He has Peter Aykroyd. I'm going to be terribly honest. I don't actually know his affiliation, but he is related. I think maybe it's his brother, but it could be anybody. I'm totally off on that front. His little girl. It's I believe his niece, Danielle Aykroyd. The story is that she plays the 3-year-old Connie. In the alien daughter in a flashback. And apparently the story is she went to the taping of a bit and she saw the heads and she really liked the cone heads. And so they cast her in it so she could get a cone head made and so she could have her own cone. And that was super cute. I love that kind of story. It's just a nice, you know, it's a nice nepotism. You know, oftentimes we get crappy nepotism.
Benign.
Yes, exactly. No one's getting hurt. Also,
it's a feel-good movie.
Yes. A shout out too to Lisa Jane Persky, who plays Lisa Farber. She played their kindly neighbor once they sort of made it to the middle class. She's had a great deal of great films. She's in When Harry Met Sally, The Great Santini, and I feel like she's not given credit and she's sort of forgotten, but she does a great job sort of being the quote unquote all American wife who sort of, you know, puts the bug in Jane Curtin's ear about her husband having an affair, all these little things. And she does it really well. And she just is one of those actresses who works really hard, does a fantastic job. And for some reason has never really gotten a lot of notoriety.
I noticed that. I couldn't really find much on her, like what else she'd done. Apparently her photography is more of her career than film ever was.
Yep. And she's still, and you know, she's in Circles because she's still done some of these huge movies. Of course, playing her husband is one of my favorite people in the entire world, Jason Alexander. I
looks so young.
I know. And with his the fake hair, I assume it looks fake. I assume it's fake hair. I mean, it's just, it's fantastic. And I appreciate that he's been working a little more lately at some TV stuff. And I got to say, he's one of those actors who, when he started to lose weight, and he's still not, you know, super slim, but he's thinner. When he started to lose weight, he was told straight on after Seinfeld, you're not going to get work if you lose weight. And he said, you know what? I'd rather lose weight. Screw it. And sure enough, he still gets work because he's Jason Alexander and he's a comedy genius. So suck it.
You don't have to be fat for voice work.
True. It's true. It's true. Yeah, he's currently the landlord in the Harley Quinn animated series right now too. Kevin Nealon is in this as a senator. It's Kevin Nealon's always nice to see. He's very, very small part, but he carries it. Of course, Tom Arnold as a one little tiny bit jerky golfer who he plays his typical jerk, you know. You can tell we've literally just been talking for 20 minutes on just the essential cameos in this film. And there's more. Phil Hartman is in it.
I was going to ding you for not saying his name yet.
Oh. Phil Hartman, I love and miss Phil Hartman so much, but I have to say his role is the one where I would say, agree with you, Tad, where I feel like it was the most wasted opportunity because he's hilarious. And it's just not, he doesn't have really any comedy moments.
Yeah. I mean, it's a shock going, you know, watching a movie from the early 90s and seeing some of these people. I'm like, wow, I have not seen them in 20 plus years. Yep. It makes you pause for a second.
Sure. And I mean, some of these before they were big, yes, SNL, you know, they may have been on SNL, but I mean, Adam Sandler did not have that big a career at this point. You know, like these people are, we recognize them now more than we would have recognized them at the time.
Yeah.
Which is interesting.
So like, yeah, I mean, I totally get where you guys are seeing with like the token bit, but it actually didn't bother me. Maybe because I was in the mindset of like SNL. Mm-hmm. You know, it almost played out like a series of sketches where, you know, this week, Ellen DeGeneres is our guest star on SNL. You know what I mean? It almost played, and I almost thought it was impressive that while doing that, they put together a full narrative with character arcs, et cetera, et cetera. You go through the entirety of, you know, the character development of all three of these Coneheads that are kind of the main, as well as the immigration officers, but you go through their arc essentially throughout the entire story with all these other characters just kind of weaving in and out. You almost expect to see Sinbad again, you know, like after he's like, you know, like, oh, Sinbad, like this guy's going to be like an important part of, I don't even remember their names. Anyways, Dan Aykroyd's character's Beldar. Life. Yep. Beldar's life. And then, you know, he's just gone, right? You know,
there's certain things they do show up occasionally, but yes, for the overall narrative, they are gone. And I think, I agree with you. I'm not mind. I actually really like seeing the cameos, but I will say when you're given a part with multiple scenes like Phil Hartman's, they could have worked some better writing in there.
I kind of see that more of like, when you're writing an SNL sketch, which I assume this was written by, you know, SNL writers, you write characters that are like, you know, the focus point of the scene and they're the funny one. And, you know, Phil Hartman actually played a lot of the flat characters in SNL sketches.
True.
Though he is, you know, when they give him the focal point, like, oh man, you know, nothing's better than Phil Hartman in my mind. I love his voice and I love when he gets a little like sarcastic.
I agree with you. And one thing, I actually think that the biggest success of this movie, and by the way, you're right, it is some writers, Bonnie and Terry Tyler, who not only did they write Coneheads, but they wrote Wayne's World, Wayne's World 2, and a lot of TV, Third Rock from the Sun, even some non, you know, heavy comedy stuff, Tommy Boy. It feels like a full narrative. I didn't feel, this isn't Super Troopers. It's not a bunch of sketches chucked together with a huge amount of ad lib. It is a true film with a beginning and end. And there's lots of bits that where they sort of captured to me the best part of a successful SNL skit. And I'm going to be honest, I don't like SNL anymore. I liked it in the Belushi days, you know, like watching reruns with my parents because, you know, even, and that's even before, you know, kind of before this, but the Dan Aykroyd era, Jane Curtin, Michael Richard, this is really like the last golden age. And now you have stuff where I feel like people get successful and they leave SNL to be better at their job elsewhere, like in stand-up comedy or anything like that, or Pete Davidson moving on to more less comedic roles, things like that happen. But the stuff that they keep from SNL that's successful are the bits where they really double down on the sort of absurdity in the midst of reality. Because SNL skits usually have that, like you said, the straight character, often the guest, and then the complete insane scenario that they're handling at that time with the other characters. And this is one of those cases. Jane Curtin is making breakfast for her family of aliens here.
Good morning, parental units.
Dawn greetings, young one.
What would you like for consumables? Pop-Tarts, chicken embryos, seasoned patties of ground animal flesh?
I'm not really hungry. Just some Tang.
Ah, Tang, the drink the astronauts took to the moon.
Astronauts to the moon.
I love their laugh and their weird sounds. I mean, and when they make fun of our culture, it's also pretty funny to me. Like one of the first things in the film is when they crash land, they get the hotel room, and Beldar goes in the bathroom and starts like eating soap and toilet paper off the roll. And you're like, okay, this is ridiculous slapstick. But Jane Curtin's character sits back on the bed, picks up the Gideon Bible, starts flipping through it, and just starts laughing as she's flipping through the Gideon Bible. I mean, that's blasphemous and hilarious. And I really enjoyed those moments.
This movie feels real all the time. More real than a comedy feels like it should be. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is no situation in the entire movie where you go, yeah, this totally wouldn't happen. Like they just, they did that good of a job where it's just like, in fact, nobody panics about the fact that someone at some point would have been like, you know what? These are clearly not humans, but everyone kind of just rolls with it. And they're just like, they're not human, whatever. they just get over it. Especially yep. that reminds me of, due to the sector of work that I work in, the INS guy, the head guy, absolute spot on in terms of how a government worker acts. Basically, they will crusade the moment up until the moment where they get that promotion and they move on. And then that line where he's like, let the next guy handle it. I'm like, that's government right there. That is straight up government.
That's really terrifying.
That's what I have to deal with every day. So yeah, that's normal.
And you're talking about Michael McKean, who is so good at playing the bad guy, often the bureaucrat, in a startling number of movies.
Yeah.
I mean, that is his role. And I think it's because he's got he's imposing. He's kind of large. He has a very cut features, big eyebrows. He played Mr. Green in Clue. He was in A Mighty Wind. He was in This Is Spinal Tap. He's been in just a shockingly large number of successful things. He also more recently was in Good Omens, the television series. I think it's his character is in a way more of a stereotype satire than you know. Beldar and Primat as aliens who don't understand humankind, because they're sort of learning and adapting and learning to enjoy the things that our lives have to offer here in the U.S. And Michael McKean is just like, he's just nasty. He just doesn't, he's not a good person. I also appreciate though that he's also not, we don't see him be really evil. Like, I think it depends on your definition of evil. You know, I think a lot of us right now with INS are not happy with them. I live here in Southern California, and some of the things that the federal government has tried to impose are not nice. But not to get into that, he's never out to kill anybody necessarily, but he wants to nail them. And that's just his white whale. And in that way, they sort of keep it light, even though it really has a lot of these large issues that affect so many of our lives in it. I wasn't sad while watching this movie, but I felt like it also didn't trivialize reality.
Yeah. I mean, so if I were to kind of mark that the INS agent with a kind of alignment, I would say that he was like lawful neutral. He kind of was very latched up on the rules, and, you know, whatever it takes to get it done, because it's just about the rules.
Sure.
I think that, you know, it's like the people and the, you know, the emotions and, you know, whatever else is going on just doesn't matter. It's just, you know, we're following this rule. They're not supposed to be here, so they're not going to be here.
And I mean, he's racist, right? Like, he's very clearly racist in the film. So, like, especially in the beginning when he talks about, you know, the stealing our jobs and all this that stuff, it's all of the things we've heard in nicer forms on talking head cable news shows for the past 30 years, but especially since 2006, right? Like, or 2016, like it's pretty crazy. And so to see it, it looks like a satire of people we see and hear every single day. It's sort of like, my wife says this all the time, whenever we click through something and somebody says insane garbage about, you know, foreigners or something else. It's like, just say you don't like brown people. And that's really what this character does, right? He kind of says that straightforward in the beginning. And you're like, oh, he's the villain. Okay, we'll go. I understand. His motivations are clear to me without having to illustrate them that much.
Yeah. He doesn't need to actually kill somebody or...
Right.
Yeah.
Something we haven't mentioned, which I think is Michelle Burke, who plays Connie Conehead. And I thought she did a fantastic job. And I... was kind of, I guess I was a little surprised that I haven't seen her in more high profile things. I mean, she still works. She was in the same year, she was in Dazed and Confused. She played Jody. And she was the next year, she was in Major League 2 as Nikki. So it's like, she's still being in things. She was in LOL with the Miley Cyrus vehicle in 2012. She's got another film coming out called Alone later this year. So she's still acting, but I thought she did a good job. She brought a little bit of sort of girl next door sexiness to this hilariously bizarre looking alien, right? Who just, as just this 80s girl who wants to, you know, go to the mall and have fun with her friends. I was surprised I haven't seen her more.
I get the feeling that Connie is the archetype for any boy growing up in our age that has a fetish for bald chicks.
Probably. And I mean, I love the costume design for this film is also fantastic, because Beldar, the more quote unquote American he gets, the more he wears like Argyle sweater vests, like exactly what a 50s dad would wear. Like, he wears all of those things when he's golfing. He wears like the next step up from something that's realistic but funny to ridiculous and funny. And Connie wears just like really great wearable 90s fashion. Lots of denim jackets, acid wash, you know, a white, you know, sheer tank, like just, you know, dangly earrings, just very 1990s Saved by the Bell, you know, before everything went terribly wrong with Buffy the Vampire Slayer fashion. You know what I mean? Like, it really worked.
Is this where you delineate the fashion line, Buffy?
I do, because if you watch Buffy the Vampire Slayer, my wife is a devout lover of Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Worst costuming ever.
I'll have to revisit, because I do love that series, but I never paid attention much to the wardrobes.
It's something to behold. Now, I'll say it's very Midwestern real. I will give it that. but that is something else. Let's see here. So, I mean, like I said, I really enjoyed watching this film again. I think that it was one of those things where if you like silly comedies, you know, if you grew up maybe a little younger and you're not, you never saw this and you're used to watching Anchorman, watch this movie. It's fun. You could watch it with all the members of the family. It doesn't mean there's tame jokes, but it means that there's, you know, it's sort of one of the family films that I feel like we don't get very often anymore. I also want to shout out to sci-fi fans. There's some awesome effects in this. Like when they go back to the Conehead planet, I mean, we have Blade Runner-esque visuals in the city. We have sort of dark Klingon-esque spaceship traveling scenes. And then we have this awesome stop motion animated battle with Beldar and this big
just call it a rancor.
It's exactly a rancor. I mean, that is exactly what it is. It's like the Flarg or something, something like that. They call it Nargle the Flarg, I think is what they say. And it's just like, oh, because he capped his teeth, the Coneheads say that he's a traitor to their culture. So he has to fight this big beast. And actually, I've got a clip here of one of my favorite moments of this when he is in the pit hiding from this creature.
Sometimes I feel I want to run away. I want to get away from the.
It's a song.
Big hit on her.
Part of me.
And of course, they're constantly this you know, amphitheater full of Coneheads making their like trademark grunting sounds like. And you have him singing Soft Cell's Tainted Love. And I both love the scene because I love Tainted Love, and I think him singing it is hilarious while he's in essentially a loincloth fighting a giant stop motion animated creature with a makeshift golf club. And you also have then the INS officer and his little assistant talking to like this beautiful Conehead woman, like it's a song, very popular on Earth. You know, it's just like it's nothing we haven't seen before plot-wise and script-wise, but it's put in such insane context in this scene that I'm like, it's like it's brand new to me. You know, it's like you take a scene from a rom-com and you throw it in the middle of a Star Wars sketch, and it works for me. Let's see. Okay, so to speak of Coneheads, we're going to move on, but we'll go with Jeff. Who would you recommend this film to if you would recommend it?
Oh man, you know, I think it's just kind of, you know, the lovers of, you know, those people that came on screen, you know, like if you love Ellen, you're going to get excited when she pops on the screen even for a second. I think it also really, it really lays into, if you're really into kind of topical comedy, you know, just something that plays in the moment, even though this was made a long time ago, it still is pretty relevant today. And, you know, pretty similar to the comedy that's being made today, even though it's a little dated now.
Yep. So Paul, it's sort of like watching an episode of The Simpsons from 20 years ago and then realizing that it, you know, predicted the rise of Trump or something. It's like, you're like holy shit. Yeah, I totally agree. Tad, would you recommend this movie and to who?
Well, I mean, I'll recommend it to people. There are people out there who like SNL. If you like SNL, by all means, watch the movie. You couldn't do any worse. I mean, also, I would say if you are a fan of any David Spade movie, PCU, where he plays a twerp, definitely. He's on a top form.
For twerp movie. Fetishists?
Yes, exactly.
And just as a weird thing, I remember when David Spade had a talk show in what, early 2000s, very briefly, and one of the commercials promoting it was, tonight on my show, I have a like star firefighter who saved countless lives, so-and-so. And also I have a dog famous for Air Bud or some such movie like that. And he's like, guess which one gets paid more? And then that was it. And that made me so happy because it's shocking. All right, so we're going to move on to the next movie here. But first, I want to say who I would recommend Coneheads to. I'd recommend Coneheads to anyone who wants a light, fun comedy that's not stupid, even though the humor is stupid. Go rent Coneheads again. I think you'll be surprised. But next up, we have our cult film for the day, another Aliens Among Us tale, this time from Full Moon Video, who is one of my all-time favorite distributors and producers companies. Full Moon Video, seriously, Charles Band's gang at Full Moon Video has made some amazingly awesome cinema and some amazingly bad awesome cinema too. We're talking Puppet Master, Brian Yuzna's Castle Freak, all sorts of things. But in this case, we have Bad Channels, which is directed by Ted Nicolau. He is probably most known for directing the Subspecies series of vampire movies. There's actually a new one on the pipeline, or it's already out this year, that was crowdfunded. So check that out if you're interested in sort of really weird, whispery vampire movies. I think it's a good one. But he's also made a gajillion movies in every genre. We're talking kids movies, horror movies. It's hard to pick something he hasn't. I guess I don't know that he's made a Western. We'll throw that out there. But yes, this movie is called Bad Channels, and it is so 1990s that it's actually 1980s. That's what it feels like.
I'd call that accurate.
Yeah, it's we're talking lower budget with Coneheads, but you still get a lot of alien mayhem. I think what most people are going to be shocked by with this movie is that it's actually a framing story around three music videos. So we have a framing story of a sort of counterculture DJ who's trying to rig it so he gets some TV airtime to boost his career. But an alien shows up, takes over the radio waves, and makes him keep talking so that people will keep listening, because he uses some little video scanner to scan women who are listening and beam them into tiny form, into like a 12-inch tall form, into these tubes, presumably so we can take it back to wherever. And I don't know if this is some kind of disturbing Spank Bank situation alien or whatever. He just waves at them. So I don't know. But that's the premise of the story. And then we get these interludes of music videos where the women that this creature has picked to abduct sort of go into a trance listening to the music, and the band actually comes into the room for them. No one else can see it, but they're rocking out. And at the like climax of the song, they get abducted and put into these tubes. And the DJ is stuck in the booth with this going on, having to figure out and share with the world who doesn't believe him what the alien is up to. Does that sound accurate?
That's pretty accurate, yeah.
Sounds like a lot, but it's really not. Alien comes to radio station, abducts women through the airwaves. Music videos are the trigger to abduct them.
It's MTV.
Yes, yes. So, Tad, what was your, yeah. what did, when you were going through this movie, what did you think?
Okay, I am a very big stickler for the soundtrack of a film. And this actually had one of the best soundtracks I'd ever heard, because I am a huge fan of 80s hair metal. And this was like, this was a hidden gem. I had no idea this movie existed. And afterwards I was like, shit, I need a copy of this too. Because the music in it was fantastic, which the first thing I did after I watched this movie was run out and see if I could get it on Amazon Music. And lo and behold, I could, because it's Blue Oyster Cult and it had to be on there somewhere. Blue Oyster Cult, collaborating with DMT and Psychotic Symphony.
Yeah. Yeah. So just to throw it out there, if there are Blue Oyster Cult fans, there's two tracks on this that they wrote specifically for this. And then an entire, it's not orchestral, but an entire score that they did. That's like, I think 20 tracks somewhere around there. And so the soundtrack, if you're a Blue Oyster Cult fan, is sort of an obscure must have. The other bands mentioned, there's a few. My favorite song on here is actually Blind Faith by Fair Game, who, if you look, Fair Game, the lead singer, has done some other projects as well, but it is a rockin' 80s anthem, and it is the first song to come up in like the music videos, and it is awesome. I really enjoyed that, and I thought Tad would probably like that one too.
Oh, absolutely.
Jeff, what was your takeaway when you were watching this?
Oh my, you know, I honestly, like, I kind of walked in thinking it was like, ugh, like, this is going to be a slog. You know, it started out kind of that way a little bit for me. Like, I found the DJ a little annoying in the first scene, which I think he was meant to be. But you know, it drew me in. Like, it definitely, at the end, I was sold. I very, very much enjoy this film. You're correct in that it's definitely a framing for three music videos that I thought got increasingly better as the film went on. So the first one's kind of get you in, and then the last one was, I thought, wonderful.
Brilliant.
And you know, yep. One of the kind of the you know, showpieces of the film. But yeah, I mean, this is a, I think the one flaw that I would have to say, and it's probably just due to limitations of being able to film, is what you mentioned. We have no idea what the motivation of these aliens are. You know, is it some sort of, you know, sexual fetish that, you know, they steal people from planets? Is it kind of Interstellar 555, where this is a girl band that they are kidnapping to then be entertainers in the, you know, intergalactic scene, which kind of would make sense, right? The musical interlude is like a audition, you know, to be in this girl band, and then, you know, they don't get a chance to refuse, you know, entry. So, you know, I think it's just today's audience is going to kind of expect that sort of, you know, depth to the story. Though it, for me, you know, being able to use my imagination and supplant my own was almost refreshing in kind of a way that I didn't expect, because I generally like to have things on the screen just show me the, you know, tell me the story. I don't want to tell it myself, but in this case, it really worked for me. I like the abstract element.
I'm going to be honest. So what you're saying is it sounds like the lazy screenwriting actually gave you freedom to think more during the film.
Which I usually hate, but it just in this case, it worked. Yeah.
Well, and so to get an idea of what this framing story sort of the quality is, let's listen to the beginning where the DJ, Dan O'Dare, who is played by Paul Hipp, who is actually, I think, a very competent actor. He's given a lot of monologuing in this film because he's essentially just talking to no one over the airwaves. Let's listen to it here.
Yo, KGULAM turntable, where the last polka recording on Earth has been playing nonstop for 20 hours and 14 minutes!
Ladies and gentlemen, you'll never hear another tuba horn on its frequency again.
Here's my concern with this movie. It's not a concern, it's a criticism. Ad-libbing is a very specific skill set. And if you don't know how to ad-lib, I don't think it's worth doing. And I'm not saying that Hit doesn't do an okay job as Dan O'Dare. I think he does. I think he's probably the strongest actor in this film. But for me, a framing story that doesn't have super strong writing, that is, I mean, an hour and a half long for three music videos, there needed to be more. You needed to either have more music or you needed to have some funny banter somewhere. And I didn't find, honestly, I think there's two sort of puns or jokes that I can think of in the entire thing. One of them is Bunny, the high school ditz who calls in a couple of times and gets abducted. She says like asking for a combination to unlock Dan O'Dare so he can take the poker record off, and he won't do it until and start playing rock and roll until somebody guesses the combination and they also win a car. It's a lot of unnecessary information. She gives him measurements, and it's clearly the measurements for like a very sexy woman. And he's like, you sound a lot more interesting than I thought. I don't even know if that qualifies as a joke. It's kind of a quip. And then he has a couple of like, you know, sexual jokes that are just, they're not even jokes. That's the thing. I think as far as humor goes, it's a goofy story that's not funny. And to me, I did find it a slog. And I've also watched this movie several times. So it might be that if you're not the kind of person to watch a movie multiple times anyway, you're not going to mind that as much. Mm. But I was sort of like, okay, Dan O'Dare's still talking. And this isn't really to rip on the screenwriter. Of course, Charles Band, who runs Full Moon Video, this is from an original idea by him. And that's the case for a lot of their films. But Jackson Barr wrote this, and he's written lots of other movies that are I think way better quality from Full Moon. For example, he wrote Transfers 2, which was fun. He wrote the 93 version of Mandroid, not the recent one, but especially he wrote Robot Wars in 1993 also, which I love that movie. That is a fantastic little known sci-fi mech warrior fantasy. Totally check that movie out. So he can do some good stuff. This is not his greatest work. Ted Nicolau, I think his, as a director, I love his atmosphere. I love the setup and the vibe he gives in his movies. He's able to differentiate it between films, but it still feels like his kind of atmospheric movie. But pacing is not his strong suit. Pacing has never been his strong suit. Anyone who is a fan of Subspecies will know this. There's a lot of scenes that, yes, they go from A to B, but they kind of meander before they get there. The music videos are fun. Except, and I'm going to jump in here and critique that they get better. The second music video, that song is everything that is wrong with 90s and early 2000s music. Oh, it is the worst, like, oh.
Okay. I don't remember it, so I'm not going to argue on this.
It's the one that started off sounding like a Tool song.
Yeah, yes, it's by DMT. It's by DMT. It's called Touching Myself Again. And this is what happens. When you grow up listening only to Guns N' Roses and then Alice in Chains comes out and then you think, I'm going to do that. You come up with a song whose chorus is touching myself again, hoping that she'll be my friend, touching myself again. Now, okay. Full disclosure, Tad and I have been in several bands together before, and the Chud who provides our music is one of those bands. And I will tell you this, I have written some horrible lyrics. I have written some god-awful, ridiculous lyrics.
We have written some awful songs.
And yet I don't think I despise any of them as much as I despise that chorus. It is it is heinous. And then you have their bass player who is just wearing a giant denim onesie with no shoes. Who's looming over the guitar. It literally looks like you stepped into, you know, I don't know, 1998, 1999 into an FYE music store and just walked up when they still had those kiosks you could listen to. And that was the first thing. It's like, oh, Stone Sour and this band. And it was bad. I didn't like it. I'm sorry, DMT. I'm sure you're wonderful people. I'd love to have you on the show. But I despise that song. And I thought it was the weakest music video by far. They're in a gym.
Yeah. It goes to show it's amazing how much collaboration you and I have been able to do, considering every time you have an issue, it's like, oh, that's my favorite. That was my favorite one.
That is unfortunate. That's a terrible. I'm not even gonna talk about the fact that you said the third Pirates of the Caribbean movie was the best either. We're not gonna talk about that.
I have
respect for you. I'm not gonna bring that up.
That one needs its own podcast.
Yeah. So
can terrible. I be there to watch you two fight?
But you can ref. Here's the thing. Fight. I think we can.
Okay, you win then. you being Nate.
It sounds like Jeff and I agree, though, that probably the best song, the most fun was, and not only, I mean, I bought this soundtrack on vinyl. Okay, I have the soundtrack on vinyl. It's not just as a curiosity. I actually think it's pretty great. Of course, Boys Sure Cold's fantastic. I did really like Fair Game song, but Psychotic Symphony, and that's Psychotic Symphony, just to be cute. These guys are fantastic, and they did the third music video, and there was also do the main credit song. And let's just listen to a piece of this song here. The song is in the video. It's called Manic Depresso. Okay, it's madness. It's pure madness. And the video is equal madness. They're in a hospital. The woman being abducted is a nurse. She ends up like taking off her gown and having like a black slip and sexy garters. And it is truly nuts. Now, this band in this video, there's a nurse. They're dressed up weird. There's one in a nurse outfit. The lead singer is in a cow outfit with an udder and weird face paint. It's like, this was the sort of insanity that Slipknot thought they were doing, which was just, they played it serious and it just doesn't work. It's just, in my opinion, commercial crap. Psychotic Symphony got it, okay? It's insane. It's like if you took Dr. Demento and mixed it with Guar and you had a band, that's these guys. And it totally is worth seeing. It really also indicates when you go from the first one with Blind Faith, where it's a very 80s metal hairband song, and then you go to the end and you get to what really is like the very small amount of underground bizarre metal from the 2000s. Because remember, that's when metal became popular again, and we got all sorts of garbage new metal bands jumping around. And this is that very small layer that was still underground. I think they're great. I worship these guys. They're as weird as they pretend to be, and it totally works. It totally works. But yeah, that was my favorite video. So that actually really elevated the film for me, because the slog between, you know, the dialogue that I didn't think was that great, and then you get this song, and I'm like, great, now let's head to the finish. And then you end with another Psychotic Symphony song in the credits, and it brought me around.
It's like squeezing some Primus and then mixing some Scatterbrain as well, as if Scatterbrain had another album besides that one they had. Oh, I wish they had put out another album.
Reach out to us. We'll produce you. I guess that to me was pretty fantastic. I do, again, just to return to the fact that I think it's weird though to have this film that's essentially a framing story and you only have three videos. Because it's an hour and a half. Those three videos are like, they're less than 10 minutes a piece. So it
could have been 10 girls in the cubes at the end.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And you have, and you just didn't have it. A lot of the movie, I think part of the reason why it sort of chugs for me a little bit is a lot of it is just Paul Hipp's Dan O'Dare character monologuing into a microphone, saying essentially the same thing over and over again, which is, people, listen to me. This is real. It's terrible. Now I'm going to describe what he's doing. I don't need you to describe what he's doing. I know they're listening, but I'm watching. Okay. Mm-hmm. I don't need the blow by blow. And also, so the alien is accompanied by like his helper robot, right? So the alien has what Dan O'Dare's character calls a scrotum head. And it's kind of accurate. It looks like a giant green scrotum. I mean, it's huge. It's like this big over a person's shoulders, and a little tiny viewfinder that you never see through. And then a cool space outfit. Like, I like his design. It's funky. I like it. And then you have a robot who is really cool. Looks sort of like Fugitoid from the comic and from Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Like this little dainty robot with sort of brain head. And who explodes gloriously, spoiler alert, in the movie. But they're sort of setting up the audio equipment, and they have this fungus that they cover everything with. Fungus, because it probably is easy to make foam insulation look like fungus, would be my guess. But here's a clip of Dan O'Dare, and this is really what a huge chunk of this movie's like.
A little while ago, Quirky fought with the aliens trying to rescue a 12-inch girl from a glass bubble. Recognized her as a waitress from the local truck stop. Quirky Bradford tried to save that girl. The aliens killed him.
That's what we get. And I cut it there because there's like two more minutes of it, of that one little bit. And it's sort of like, I guess it's just not necessary. It's this time filler. And I feel like a lot of the movie is a time filler.
Oh, yeah.
And so that was my biggest complaint with this one. The effects are okay. You get some good direct-to-video effects with the alien and the creature. And if you have a good creature in it, I'm going to give you a pass, because that's the hardest part. Everything else is sort of phoned in. There's a lot of green spray insulation. There's a lot of there's a couple of scenes of like fungus that some guy gets infected with at the hospital that reacts to the radio music and like thrives around like weird little penile heads. And that works. I mean, we've all seen it before, but it's not bad. I don't know if you guys bought the effects.
I thought like that scene ended up being like a little confusing. It was probably because of production, you know, the ordering of events, and like, you know, it felt a little, it would lack cohesion throughout the scene. From moment to moment, I had to rewind a couple times. I was like, what happened? What just happened there? Like, and it was like, oh, they never actually showed what happened. So I have to just make an assumption as to the scenario, you know, and this character is, you know, somehow super good with these, you know, like hentai dildos, like instantly, you know, I mean, yeah, the film is, you know, like you said, maybe missing like 50, like, you know, script elements. And for some reason, I guess when I was watching it, I was filling them in myself, and that, that was entertaining for me.
Sure.
And I think the only thing that, that it really needed was like at the end to like maybe have like a scene or two that kind of just brought those, all of those questions like to, for, you know, cause like I have my opinions on how this happened. It was like, oh, there was like some sort of brilliant plot to keep this guy talking. Cause like they knew he was going to keep talking if they kind of ignored him and like let him go. Like he couldn't stop talking. It was like cycle, like, you know, part of his psychology that, that he just, all he had to do was stop talking. And there's a scene where it basically was like, oh, if I stop talking, all of the problems will go away. And he keeps fucking talking. He just keeps talking. So it's like, they picked the perfect guy who has like this weird, you know, inability to shut up. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they have this kind of a Machiavellian plot to steal these women. But then it just, it never, they never conclude it, you know, and it's like, it could have ended with, you know, a scene of the one woman that they did end up kidnapping, you know, singing in front of like a bunch of aliens, you know, and it's like, oh, okay, that, now I understand why they're doing this. At least
you're really stuck on this Interstellar 555, which
I am. That was the movie I watched, by the way.
In case you guys don't know what that is, it is an anime film that's created around an amazing Daft Punk album. So it's actually, I believe it's out of print and kind of hard to find, but you can watch it online, or, you know, I highly recommend you buy the film somehow. It is an awesome film. So it'd be a good pair for this one. But yeah, I agree with you. I think that sort of what you're saying with it's clearly not supposed to be taken seriously. And because it's that, it's like, it feels like a late night monster flick fare. And it works. And I enjoyed the weird music interludes, because it is unusual to hear music take the center stage as opposed to just the background.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think, Jeff, you were saying that the video itself also is like the audio, right? Like it took center stage and sort of took over the picture.
Yeah. And that absolutely. Yeah, that was like, you know, that was like the charismatic lead of the film was the vinyl music video. Yeah.
I totally agree with you on that front. I think one of the things that was irritating to me is the female co-star lead or co-lead. She's the news reporter who's sent to interview Dan O'Dare, and then she finds out that it was all a marketing stunt that she put together. And it's the actress is Martha Quinn. Her character's name is Lisa Cummings. Now, so she's been in some awesome bad movies, by the way. She's in, she was in the Weird Al show. I don't know if anybody remembers that from the late 90s. She was in Chopper Chicks in Zombie Town, very well known in the cult circles. Eddie and the Cruisers 2, Eddie Lives, which is a weird film if you ever watched the first one. It's like, just kidding, he's not dead. So she's done some stuff. I don't think she's a bad actress, but her character is completely motivationless. She's angry at Dan O'Dare, and I don't really know why 100%. Like, it sounds like she has a crappy job and a crappy boss anyway. And so when he's like, yes, I set this up so you'd come interview me, she's like, yeah, like you're beneath me. And I'm like, you're in the middle of nowhere for a nowhere news channel. Why are you so angry? Did anybody else pick up on that? Like the unmotivated anger?
It was an awkward scene for sure. I didn't understand her character. And I don't know if it was just because like the writer had like written like three pages of script that then they're like, we're not going to shoot that. I don't know what it was, but like she didn't make any sense. Like,
And it's almost like we're supposed to like, it's like we were given the trope of like, bad boy, good girl, good girl's like, no, bad boy, you're not for me because you're not good. And then at the end, like, oh, it all comes around. Like, that's the trope, right? And it's like, we're supposed to just assume that. But it's sort of like when you miss key components of the trope to make it make sense, when you actually think about it, you're like, wait, what the fuck is happening? And I think that's what happened here, because that's how we start the movie, is she's like, get out of here, Dan O'Dare, you're a loser. And then like, at the end, he comes out and they embrace and have a passionate kiss. And you're like, what? Are you guys in love somehow? What happened? Like, you guys haven't spent any more time together. He's been locked in a booth talking to no one on a radio. And she's been, I don't know, hulking a camera around herself, filming people in the hospital. Like, you're like, what? Where did this romance blossom?
Well, I mean, that's part of the trope, right? Like, all of a sudden, we have feelings for each other. Why? I don't know.
You saved me, you Yay. Know, from a bubble. Yay.
And also,
you now own me.
Right, right. You're like, no, you're still kind of a sleazebag who lost his job for having, he lost his job, right, at being, for having sex on the air with an officer, a police officer or something. And then he got hired by this polka station that realized they could broadcast nationwide over channel 666. So they, which by the way, I'm actually disappointed that it wasn't some sort of supernatural.
I was certain that was where it was going. Yeah.
Right. Because you have a setup like that. Like, I expect Satan to take over the airwaves. And for metal, you could have had the most badass metal. Like, I would like to do a version of this movie where it is like a supernatural demonic presence. That's great.
It was a bait and switch. They're like, hey, you're going to get demons. Oh, then it's aliens.
Yeah. We only had blue and green spray paint, not red and yellow spray paint. So yeah. You're out of luck.
Got to work with what you got.
Right.
Let me talk a little bit about this actress or this character more specifically, because Nate, I'm still unsure, three episodes in, if your choices are based on your severe love for Ninja Turtles or whether it's my bias towards Ninja Turtles, because obviously this is one of those movies that it feels because of the, as I would put it, the Hollywood incest. A lot of these themes seem to kind of mush together, plus, you know, a lot of people work on the same stuff. I got a real big April O'Neil vibe from that actress. And for a while, I was like, was she an April? There were three different Aprils. Was she one of them? Did she do the voice for April?
She was not, but...
She was not.
I can see the vibe, yeah.
Yeah, so bear with me. This is going to be just like with Ultimate Fight. This felt... like another Ninja Turtles side story, except the turtles never showed up. April's pissed off because what's his name, her boss, sent her down some bullshit story once again. She's all mad about it. And then this all happens. And instead of the turtles actually showing up, this dude has to do it himself. And Vernon already ran off like 5 minutes into the movie. Vernon's just like, oh, peace out. I'm out.
I think the closest I'd see to that is that the alien looks like one of the 90s Ninja Turtle toys would have happened, like the exactly. Bulbous over-accentuated. I'd buy that.
Yeah. That's really it. Like, the only thing that was missing was a sewer. Like, there was no sewer scene
and a plot.
Since when did Ninja Turtles need a plot?
Blasphemy. All right, you were gonna say something, Jeff.
I was just saying, I think Tad's working a little hard to make the CCU, the cult and classic universe. I mean, if it becomes a general theme, you know, that'll be fun, but it's a bit of a stretch here.
I think it's a stretch as well. I would love it to work, but I think it's a stretch.
Oh, come on. I wasn't stretching with Ultimate Fight? Come on.
That was
Ninja Turtles, you know, 1.5. I think we've established that.
You're welcome, listeners.
So the actress, yeah, and again, like, she's been in some good stuff otherwise, so I'm sure she's great, but, and this is a hit below the belt, but it's hard when your co-star women that get abducted by the alien are like all like 80s and 90s video vixens for heavy metal films, where they're like, they're beautiful, they're tall, they're blonde, or they're bouncy, and then the alien takes her and you're like, I'm sorry, you're not ugly, but you're not beautiful. Like, and does not look like the other things.
Well, I mean, she didn't act like the other ones were, you know, a little bit.
Right, and so I'm like, Alien, why did you go in, what is the town called, Pahuda, right? It's like Pahuda, and you're like, it's supposed to be a podunk town, and you're just like, did you just not want to sketch through any of those channels, or are there only five women in the entire county, and this is the top four? Like,
so back to me writing my own version of this story. She didn't dance. I mean, this was an audition to be a intergalactic dancing girl in, you know, or, you know, girl band. Where was the dancing? She just stood there with the camera. Like, that was, I don't think she passed the audition in my mind.
No, there wasn't even a music video, really. There wasn't all. Yeah. She just gets
there's abducted. Our fourth music video we didn't get.
Right. It's just like she's abducted, and all of a sudden I'm like, wait a minute, you didn't even need the music? Like, what? Like, is this the aliens demo tape? Like, is he just putting that in there and he's like, somebody sign me. Beep, boop, boop. And I don't understand.
Nate, this is your nightmare. We're gonna do a little more research. It turns out there were 12 music videos, and they decided that Touching Myself Again was in the top three, and they threw it in there.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. It's and here's my problem, my biggest problem, besides the lyrics being bad for Touching Myself Again, is DMT in general. It sounds like there's no real strong musicality to it. It sounds like every like gibberish, one set distortion, like post prog rock, hard rock. Like, I'm like, what is this? Is this Alice in Chains? Is it Days of the New after they were no longer good? Like, what happened here? Like, is this what inspired Creed? Like, I don't understand. Like, there's no, it's just grunge without any of the talent and satire. You know, so I didn't like it at all. I'm sorry, DMT. I don't want to lose you as listeners.
It amuses me that you hate this so much. But actually, I honestly don't even really remember it very much, except for the kind of creepy band guy kind of sneaking into the scene. Yeah, based on your description and not my memory, it makes me think of the AI bots writing songs.
It's like, it is 100% by the numbers. Like, oh, yeah, this is like, what kids in the 90s, like, oh, Kurt Cobain's dead, so listen to this. And I'm like, no, I'm not going to do that. Like, I can still buy a Nirvana patch and move on with my life. You're stuck listening to this garbage. And then what shocked me is that it was so, like, the music is so disparate. The three songs that they choose really are not thematically related at all. Like, you could call them metal-ish. I think Psychotic Symphony is definitely a form of metal, and of course Blind Faith is certainly 80s metal, and then like, but then I just didn't get it in the middle. I'm like, this is something that would play on like the variety station in every town everywhere on the top 40, and it would sell a bunch of copies, and then they would, you know, become Three Doors Down.
Like, there you go, you cracked the code, man.
I know, it's just not, I didn't dig it. But that just could be me.
I think if you recall, we had a certain band member who, before joining our band, wrote a song called Riding the Dragon that was clearly about masturbation. Maybe he wrote it. Actually, no, he would be.
Who was that?
That was Dave.
Oh. Hi, Dave.
We're not going to mention his full name.
Hi, Dave. Maybe we'll have you on the show someday, Dave. I would totally be down for that.
It'd be so awesome.
Yeah, I guess I just don't like that middle song. And also, I think it's the weakest of the videos. As you said, it's in the school gymnasium. There's this weird side plot where this character, Bunny, who's one of the, you know, the for lack of better words, airhead character girls who gets abducted. She's played by Daryl Strauss, who has done some things as well. She was in a 2002 video called Shades of Grey. I'm sure she's done more, but I haven't heard of it. But I liked her character. She's like a whiny, like, am I on the air? Like kind of the Marilyn Monroe thing. But she's after school trying to learn her like cymbal solo or something with the band. And one of the bandmates is like, I don't even know how you describe him. Like, he's just this weird, like, hair parted down the middle, Weasley kind of guy who, I don't know if they're supposed to be a couple. He keeps leering at her, but then also scowling at her. And she looks at him, and he's playing tuba. And does anybody have any insight into that? I don't understand what that was.
A throwaway joke that never went anywhere. I mean, I do remember the comment about how they're like, these boys are staying after school to make sure that you can do your cymbal solo, something along those lines. And I was like, yeah, I'm sure they're doing it out of the kindness of their heart.
Yeah, that was it. And then during the music video, you know, when she goes into the trance and the band shows up playing there, and I mean, here's why I say Axl Rose, because he has the growly voice that is clearly, I mean, we all wish we were Axl Rose in vocal terms, right? But like, he also has like the headband along his stringy hair, and it's just not okay. And then while they're playing, she's rocking out but cannot dance, bless her heart, in the middle. And then this guy who, I mean, he's really like the poor man's Crispin Glover, who I'm obsessed with. But like, he's like lurching in, and I don't know, like, it's like, is he supposed to be gay and doesn't want to touch a girl? And I'm not saying all gay people don't want to touch a girl, but that was the stereotype that they were sort of playing, right? Like, he's really like weird and sort of like awkward around her, and just I don't know. That whole scene, I was just like, I understand why you don't remember it, Jeff, even though it was probably the longest friggin' video.
I remember that part.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And at the end, and this is like, it's like, well, a callback.
It was also, I mean, I do remember it was in a jib, and they were just like, it was just a band playing.
Yeah, like, because all the other ones,
much else to it, right?
All the other ones, they're not actually standing there playing the instruments, right? Like, you know, Blind Faith is all of the women playing the instruments, like, in a crowded bar. Or a diner, and like, she's the woman who's abducted is dancing on the table and stuff, and then like, and the lead singer's like screaming at like patrons at the diner table, so it made sense. Like, this looks like an 80s, like, you know.
Yeah, it was like a metal concert in a diner, you know.
This is a like Twisted Sister music video. And then you know, Psychotic Symphony's final one is like it's a madness. Like, they're in the hospital and they're all dancing, and there's each character's in a different room, and it's just, it's pure insanity, and it feels like a music video for them. But the middle one, I'm like, I guess it does feel like a music video for them, and it's just as trite and dull as I don't understand. Like, they ran out of ideas and like, oh, we better put this one in the middle because the first one and the last one are stronger. There's a callback to that weird band guy and Bunny who's abducted, because she's the only one that somehow they forget she's in the tube and don't unshrink her. I don't understand how that happened, but she's
mastered the hentai, you know, penises, but he just missed one, and then, you know, they figured it out later.
And here's the thing. So fans of Full Moon video series will remember Doll Man, who came out, I think, 2 years, 91, somewhere around there, one or 2 years before this film. And it's about a tiny alien who is a badass, like, bounty hunter kind of guy. And it's fun. I love it. There's a semi-sequel crossover film as well. But did either of you guys catch the post-credit scene for this one? Because the post-credit scene is starring Doll Man. He's hitchhiking or walking along this big empty stretch of road, presumably towards Pahuda. And he's like, I'm going to Pahuda. Apparently there's a 12-inch tall girl named Bunny, and she could use some cheering up. And that's like, and then it's like, Doll Man, come see Doll Man. And I loved that sort of like pre-Marvel, but post like 1970s teaser, you know, for another film at the end. I thought that was a nice touch, because it feels like that kind of movie that would have another. And I love the Full Moon, again, connected universe, that Full Moon was like, all of these things happen in the same realm, you know, Puppet Master, Demonic Toys, all of these things are in the same world.
It's really weird seeing how many studios tried to pull something off like that before the form was finally perfected.
Well, and I mean, to be fair, like, Full Moon Video has been doing it for decades now, right? Because you have so, like, their films cost so little money overall that they can make a million and do an entire crossover film. Like, Demonic Toys did, you know, Demonic Toys versus Doll Man, or Doll Man versus Demonic Toys. Like, it's a full crossover film. You have Puppet Master versus Demonic Toys. You have lots of crossovers in the Evil Bong movies that Charles Band has made. Like, so they really, when you don't have the freedom, I mean, you have the freedom of not like being responsible to a really large studio, I think that you can do stuff like that. And if it doesn't work, who cares? It's still out there, and they just make another one. You know, they make another Puppet Master that's serious again. You know, it doesn't have to be this, oh God, this was a multi-million dollar flop. We're not, you know, The Mummy is no longer connected to the Brendan Fraser The Mummy. You know, it's like, it's not going to happen.
Universal trying to jump the gun there and falling flat on their ass.
They tried.
I don't know how hard they tried though. It looked like they had no plan whatsoever.
Who knows? You know, Warner, I love DC Comics, Warner Brothers. They're my boys. They're my girls, but they're my everything in between. But they have been falling victim of this oversensitivity to focus group and crowd reaction that has caused them to switch and back and forth and delay and rewrite so many things so many times that, you know, it's the kind of thing that a studio like Full Moon Video doesn't have to do. And that's why I applaud them.
Yeah, this was one of those movies that kind of made me miss when you could make a movie like this, a stupid, pointless movie that was clearly a lot, like, they probably had a blast making this movie, or at least I would have had a blast writing it, coming up with these stupid ideas. We've done that before. It's like, what's the stupidest idea we can come with and try and make an actual decent film out of it?
Right.
I miss this. You can't get movies like this anymore because no one either has the money or they won't take the risk, or someone did make it and you don't know about it because they can't market it.
And I mean, that's, it's true to an extent. Although I will say that you can see it if you go to Full Moon Features. Yeah, sponsor us. So yeah, I mean, that's the thing. You know, you get these. I remember Donald Farmer has a Donald Farmer connected universe. yeah, and just, I also want to put a plug out for the massive amount of Full Moon Video films available on Full Moon Video streaming services, including Barbie and Kendra Save the Tiger King. Yeah, that's a thing that they actually made. So, Tad, who would you recommend this film to?
This is people who either grew up with or just enjoyed Monster Vision and wanted to see one of the movies that just never made it into the rotation, because this should have been a Monster Vision movie.
Joe Bob Briggs would have wonderfully covered this film.
I should have seen this movie back before I was in high school, but oh well, better late than never, right? So yeah, I'd recommend it to anyone who likes that. Anyone who likes not so obscure references to shitty 90s music as well.
Awesome. Jeff, what's your take?
Oh man. So, you know, both of these films, I feel like I would have hated when I was younger. And I think I did hate Coneheads when I was younger. Because I think you have to bring a lot to both of these films to enjoy them. You gotta, you know, enjoy the current state of immigration to love Coneheads. You know, you have to basically write the story of Bad Channels as you're watching it in your own imagination to get there. So I think that's, you know, I think this is more for you know, an older crowd, somebody that can really you know, bring their own experiences into a film, something that they can you know, enjoy how it relates to them and the world around them.
I don't know. It sounds like we're going to get a lot of Bad Channels fan fiction out of Jeff in the near future.
Hey, man. Sure. If the people want it, I'll write it.
I think both of you guys are right. I would recommend Bad Channels to people who miss that late night movie vibe, and also people who just want to hear some obscure music, and maybe one of those three songs you're really going to love. And also, if you're a Blueish or Cult fan, you have to watch this movie. They did the soundtrack. So if you're, and it does show, the movie's actual soundtrack beyond the music videos is far head and shoulders above the quality of most of the film itself. So I think it really is worth seeing in that. And it's worth checking out the record, which I think will be more interesting to you after you've seen the film. Although I think it certainly stands on its own, except for touching myself again, which
I would actually add to a point to that. So I watch Tron Legacy just as like a music video. It's like, I just listen to it.
Yeah, and then, Daft Punk soundtrack for that is phenomenal. Get the UK edition because it's got tracks that were not on the American release, which is ridiculous. But anyway.
So I suppose watching Bad Channels for a similar reason would make
sense. Yeah. Sure. Yeah, it's not a bad background movie. And it might actually be a good background movie at like a party because there's weird stuff happening occasionally. And then you get these rocking tracks. So I'd give that a shot. All right. Well, that is it for this episode of Cult and Classic. As always, the audio clips that we use are used for review purposes. To play us out, we're going to have some music by The Chud. Thank you so much to The Chud. And remember, you can follow them at Facebook at facebook.com/The Chud Band. Lastly, if you like this podcast, make sure you review us on your favorite podcast platform and donate at cultandclassicpodcast.com. This is Nate Wyckoff signing off for another episode of Cult and Classic.